You are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation, a national nonprofit founded on the belief that every pregnancy deserves a happy ending. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Jane Warland, a registered midwife and lecturer at the University of South Australia. Dr. Warland is an active researcher in the areas of population health, mental health, and maternal health. Since suffering the unexplained full-term stillbirth of her daughter Emma in 1993, she has been a passionate stillbirth researcher into preventative and modifiable risk factors for stillbirth. She has presented at the Star Legacy Foundation's Stillbirth Summit and plans to do so again at the next summit in June of 2019 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dr. Warland, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
You're welcome, Chris. It's good to talk to you again.
My first question is, one of the most common concerns we hear is that health professionals don't want to scare their patients by telling them about all the bad things that can happen. Is this a significant concern, and how do you handle this with your own patients?
Chris, I get asked this all the time by care providers, so I agree with you. It's a really, really common concern. Frankly, though, it baffles me. It really does. We do a lot of education and care providers saying, I don't want to mention stillbirth because it will make women anxious. Now I tend to say to them, are any of you in the room an anxious flyer? And does getting on an airplane make you anxious? because what happens when we get on an airplane as we're taxiing out to take off is that all airlines give a safety demonstration. And they say, in the event of an emergency, this is what you need to do. And all of us who have flown often know that safety demonstration off pat, don't we? It's kind of like assume the brace position, and we've got in our heads exactly what we need to do to assume that position. We all know how to do up a seatbelt. We all know to look for our safety exits. And it's become part of the rote of flying. And I'd really like to see that same attitude adapted for healthcare providers when talking about stillbirth, because yes, it is unlikely to happen, just as an air crash is unlikely to happen when you get on a plane. But that does not stop the airline from following the duty of care and educating everyone who gets on that plane about what to do in the rare event of an emergency. And I think that we can adopt that as maternity care providers and say to women, listen, stillbirth is really rare, but unfortunately it still does happen from time to time. And here are some ways that we think that you can protect yourself from this calamity. You know, talking in those kinds of terms, I don't think is anxiety provoking. I think it's information giving.
So any time death or injury is a possibility, it seems like going through the worst case scenario is an accepted part of our culture. You know, we have to sign waivers for everything whenever death or injury is a possibility. So that leads me to my next question, which is why? And maybe you don't have an answer to it, but I have to ask it anyway as a follow-up. But why is this accepted part of our culture of going through the worst case scenario not carrying over to stillbirth and pregnancy loss?
I'm really not sure what the answer is, as you might have suspected. I think that in some ways we have an attitude towards pregnant women which is stuck with us from Victorian times. The Victorian woman announced her pregnancy by fainting, and the due date was called confinement because we used to confine women to their room and not let them get out of bed and protect them and bring them food and drink for the month before and after their birth. And, you know, we were concerned about their vulnerability to infection and all sorts of other things that we were concerned about in those days. And I think that paternalistic attitude has stayed with us. I think that we still, and in the very, at the very core of our being, believe that pregnant women are vulnerable and need protection. And I don't think that other things have changed, are applicable to stillbirth in quite the same way. So, for example, we used to protect the cancer patient by saying, oh, you know, we won't tell them about cancer because that's just a bit awful for them. So we'll just let them die in peace, not knowing really why they're dying. And that's changed. But we haven't actually changed how we talk to pregnant women and how we think that they're vulnerable. And I think it really does stem from those sorts of times that we haven't managed to somehow as a society understand that pregnant women aren't necessarily that vulnerable and that they actually do need information and empowerment and being allowed to be given agency and advocacy of bodies and over their baby. So we've got a bit of work to do there. And to be frank, I have no idea how we start to change society's view about that.
Let's shift the conversation to talking about the stigma associated with stillbirth and other types of pregnancy loss. I know you are involved with some research looking at this stigma. Why is this such a powerful phenomenon?
It's my PhD student who's actually doing her PhD on stigma. And I would hate to preempt her findings. she's in the middle right now of writing up some results, which are actually quite exciting. Suffice to say that we have made an assumption that stigma is associated with stillbirth. And I think it is. And certainly my PhD student has shown that there is an association with stigma and stillbirth. But I also think that we sometimes misunderstand what stigma actually is. And we look at one of the symptoms of stigma, which is silence, and say, because we are silent about stillbirth in our community, that means that we are stigmatising. And that's not necessarily true. So we need to be careful about making assumptions about what we think and what we know, and actually wait for the research that either confirms or denies that, as we do with everything. One of the interesting things that my PhD student has found, though, is that there were a selection of women, about a third, who believed that their stillbirth was contagious, and that therefore they didn't want to be near other pregnant women, lest they also suffer the same fate. And they also found that pregnant women wouldn't like to go near them for the same reason, that they felt like perhaps the awful thing that had happened to their friend would also happen to them. So again, we've got a body of work to be done around understanding exactly what stigma is and how we can address it. My student is also putting together a validated scale which we'll be able to use to survey people and actually get their level of stigma and the kind of stigmas that they feel that they're suffering. So that's kind of like a lifetime of work, really, that's ahead of my student. And it's really interesting. I guess sort of stay tuned, really, for more coming soon on that one.
When will this research be complete? Any idea when we'll be able to see some of the findings?
As I said, she's putting together her findings now. We should have them published by the middle of next year. And certainly she's aiming to go to the Stillbirth Summit and present some findings there. So, I hope that her paper gets accepted. we'll hear more about her research at that point.
Wonderful. The Star Legacy Foundation raises awareness and tries to make sure that families know about available support following a stillbirth or pregnancy loss. But maybe the more important awareness efforts are aimed at helping people who have never had a loss know how they can reduce their risk of stillbirth. What are the key prevention messages you want all women to hear?
I think that there are five things that the woman can do herself to try to protect herself from stillbirth. And I think that each of these needs to be, supported by the maternity care provider who's looking after the woman. So she needs to get to know her unborn baby's movements. And we now know that frequency, so the number of times that the baby moves, is important, but also the strength of the baby's movements and the pattern of the baby's movements are all important. So there's three aspects of fetal movements, not just one. So it's not just about a decrease, it's also about a change in frequency and a change in pattern. So that the woman, if she gets to know her baby, will notice a change in frequency, a change in strength, and a change in pattern. And each of those needs to be reported to her care provider. The other thing that's emerged as a risk factor that we can modify or change is settling to sleep position, or the position that you go to sleep in. We now know from multiple research studies that if a woman settles to stillbirth, it doesn't matter which side, left or right, doesn't matter. Going to sleep on your side is an important thing to do in the later third of the pregnancy. So from that 20-week mark is when the evidence suggests that women should be settling to sleep on their side. And finally, trusting her intuition and reporting if she feels that something's wrong, even if she can't necessarily put her finger right on what it is that's making her concerned. So each of those is dependent on the woman doing things, but also the care provider listening to her and paying attention to her when she reports changes, and also informing her of the kind of things that she needs to do. So that settling to sleep on the side is something that she knows, not only from information out there in the general public, but also from her maternity care provider.
You recently published a paper from the STARS study data looking at maternal intuition. And this can be a hard concept for scientists to work with. What do you think your findings can tell us, and where do you think research around intuition will go in the future?
It is a hard concept to grasp, and to be frank, it was a hard concept for some of the group who published that paper to grasp, because intuition can't be measured, and it is about trust. I think that we need to really understand, and we say this in the paper, that we trust maternal intuition once the baby is born. So it would be a very silly pediatrician indeed who had a mum come into his office with a baby, and she said, there's something wrong with that baby, you know, can you please check the baby out? Any pediatrician worth his or her soul would immediately check that baby out very thoroughly based on nothing more than the mother thinking there's something wrong. But if a pregnant woman comes into an obstetrician or midwife's office and says, feel like there's something wrong, she's often told, oh, it's natural to be anxious. in pregnancy, or, you know, that everything is fine. The only assessment which is often done is listening to the heart rate. heart rate's not really a very sensitive thing. And it's really, the baby has a heart rate until it doesn't have a heart rate. So it's not a good thing to be relying on. So the STAR study found that we had a huge number of stillborn mums who said that they had a gut instinct in the pregnancy that something was wrong. And interestingly, about a third of them who ticked yes, I think, thought that there was something wrong with the pregnancy, said that they thought that there was something wrong in the pregnancy from the beginning of the pregnancy, and that they remembered talking to their care provider or their partner or their mother or somebody about that way before there was anything that went wrong with the pregnancy towards the end of the pregnancy. So I think that the STAR study certainly tells us that listening to the mother is an important thing for the care provider to start to do. If the care provider isn't listening, then they need to learn to. That the woman can be trusted in exactly the same way as we need to trust the mum when she comes with her toddler. We need to trust the mum when she comes concerned about her unborn baby as well. Where to next? STAR Legacy are currently planning a larger study where we're going to be collecting data prospectively, so as it happens in the pregnancy. We've got an ethics application for that study under review, so it'll be starting quite soon once we have that ethics through. And we have included a number more questions about intuition to try and tease out exactly what we might be looking at there. Once we have those findings in a year or two, we'll have much more information about this really rather interesting phenomenon.
You were at the Stillbirth Summit in 2017, and you made quite a remarkable impression on a lot of people who were in the audience there when you gave some of your remarks. You made an allusion to the PhD student that you're working with is hoping to present and be accepted at the summit. Wondering, number one, are you planning to come back to the summit in 2019, which will be in June in Bloomington, Minnesota? And number two, it just sounds like from the way you talk about this summit that this is pretty important to you and people in your field. And I'm wondering, this Stillbirth Summit, how is it viewed to the outside audience, to people outside of the STAR Legacy Foundation and in your field, and why is it so important?
Yes, I am planning to come back in 2019. I'm actually going to run a pre-conference workshop about how we might be able to prevent stillbirth. So that's like a half-day workshop. Hopefully, I'll be bringing the leader of a group that's similar to STAR Legacy Foundation in Australia called Still Aware, and we'll be running that workshop together. Really looking forward to that. I've also would like to talk about some of the randomised control at the summit, particularly the ones that show that fetal awareness supposedly doesn't have, or awareness of fetal movement supposedly doesn't protect about stillbirth. That study actually doesn't show that. So that's a bit of a myth, I guess, that needs to be busted. And also talking about the study which suggests that everyone should be induced at 39 weeks to prevent stillbirth, again, another myth and a poor interpretation of what that study is actually saying. So Ashana and Lindsay from the STAR Legacy Foundation have actually asked me to put something together about those studies and to present it at the summit, and I'm very delighted and excited to be able to do that. The summit started, oh gosh, 2010, I'm thinking, or maybe 2011. That very first summit was something that I think all of us in the stillbirth research space who attended got excited about. It was the thing that triggered the STAR study, which has been an enormously successful study. And I think that because STAR Legacy have the attitude of let's pull people together who are doing the same kind or good work in the stillbirth space and perhaps work that's slightly contentious or slightly controversial, but let's, you know, get together and talk about it and present findings and then, you know, have people who have similar expertise critique it or ask questions about it. That format is invaluable to the stillbirth researcher. And I think that's why we have kept on coming back and are delighted to accept invitations when they come from that group, because it's unique. It's a unique thing that other conferences don't have that same ability or that same feel. So it is an important meeting, a very important meeting, and I guess that's why I speak about it in those sorts of terms, because it's a meeting that I wouldn't want to miss for once.
Well, Dr. Warland, you are the first two-time guest on the Stillbirth Matters podcast, and that is no coincidence and no accident. It's because we love you and we enjoy hearing your perspective, and wanted to thank you for taking the time to speak with me despite the time zone difference. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the STAR Legacy Foundation. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.